Herzlich willkommen bei Aufnahmebereit, dem Podcast für Ankommende und Aufnehmende in der modernen Migrationsgesellschaft.
Diese Folge wird Ihnen präsentiert von Courage, Mut zur Menschlichkeit.
Mein Name ist Judith Kohlenberger, ich bin Migrationsforscherin an der WU Wien und in der heutigen Folge spreche ich mit der ehemaligen Kiewer Kulturstadträtin Jana Barinova. Sie ist 2022 mit ihrer Tochter nach Wien geflüchtet und ist nun bei der Erste Stiftung für European Policies und Ukrainian Relations tätig. Wir sprechen über die Zukunft der Ukraine, über Kunst während des Krieges und über die Rolle Europas. Und weil Jana erst Deutsch lernt, führen wir dieses Gespräch auf Englisch. Welcome, Jana. It's so nice to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for the invitation.
So, Jana, I want to start with, on the one hand, a very obvious question, but also a very hard question. How would you describe the situation in Ukraine now, 3 years after the beginning of this total invasion by Russia? And how do you think has Ukraine's perception in the world changed since that time?
So after the 3 years of war, Ukraine continues to fight and continues to defend its democracy. The situation is very hard and situation is very, very complex and difficult. The battles continue and but from other hand, we eyewitness enormous courage, enormous bravery. People are united, people continue to work, businesses operate. Reconstruction efforts is already taking place. However, war fatigue, it's a real problem, both internationally and inside Ukraine. So at the beginning of the war, the whole world showed and expressed its solid commitment to support Ukraine, seeing this brave nation. Support is still there, but we need probably more unity among our external Western allies, and especially recent events that took place in America. So it goes without saying that there is still a lot of work and hard journey is ahead of us.
So with recent events, you're probably referring to the apparently changing position of the US since President Trump's inauguration, where to me as an outsider, of course, to both sides of the conflict, it appears that this was really the most dramatic change in sort of the positioning of what used to be the West towards the war in Ukraine, right? So just to recap, what we saw is since President Trump came into office, he decided to cut aid to Ukraine. He wanted to strike a peace deal, which also meant that US got primary access to Ukraine's rare earth and other mining priorities there. He was publicly humiliating President Zelensky in the Oval Office. And so to me, it almost seems like we have entered a new age in this conflict since the inauguration of Trump. Do you concur with this? Does it feel different now because alliances are shifting?
Absolutely. I witness important turning point. And if Trump's administration cuts support for Ukraine, it will be a big, big problem. And it will be even greater challenge for Ukraine to overcome, because Ukraine depends on Western aid. Ukraine depends on the supply of weapons and needs support for economic stability. So if this support weakness, I think Russia will try to take an advantage of it. But it's too early, I think, to make conclusions. From other hand, it was an awakening moment for Europe. We saw next day an enormous solidarity towards Ukraine among European leaders, and some European countries even increased their support after the situation in United States. So I hope that all European countries understand that victory of Ukraine, it's a victory of democratic values, human rights, human dignity, and European values that we fight for. So the biggest challenge would be to make that peace deal is fair for Ukraine, and Ukraine needs long-term commitments and security guarantees, not a political games. So from my perspective, a bad deal is worse than none. Deal at all. So the issue is security is the main. Ukraine needs guarantees that Russia won't attack it again in few years.
Because then it's worthless, right? What would you agree on if Putin doesn't stick to his part of the deal? It's worthless.
This is what history taught us. And
which is what President Zelensky tried to make clear to everyone listening in the Oval Office, but failed to do. Yeah.
Exactly. So Ukraine need strong alliances of friends and security guarantees. So I think we still should reach this point of negotiation. I don't think we are not there yet.
I'm always reminded when I look at the situation in Ukraine, but also other conflict areas really around the globe, of this almost ancient motto, no justice, no peace, which is true. Because if you don't get justice in whatever peace deal is being struck, you don't have lasting peace. Because it's a kind of fake peace, actually, where one side loses a lot. And I mean, there have many, many lives were already lost. But this is also about the future and the kind of future orientation of Ukraine, but also the future of Europe, as you very rightly pointed out. I also had the impression, I very much concur with you in this, that after this, on the one hand, public humiliation of President Zelensky in the Oval Office, but already before that, when Vice President J.D. Vance try to tell Europeans how to live and what to think and what to do, which was a very audacious move. I felt personally attacked by this. I felt that there was a shift also across the European Union in a positive sense, where more and more countries seem to understand we cannot remain neutral in this conflict and we actually have to step up. I mean, we heard talks about stepping up and Europe having to do more. This has been going on for months now. But now I feel like the urgency is much more there because Trump very clearly showed what the position of the US would be. And some analysts, and I have to say I find this very convincing, even argue that the US can no longer be considered part of the West in the sort of traditional sense of what the West means. Whereas Ukraine, on the other hand, I feel also when it comes to alliances, is orienting itself towards the West. And now what I would like to ask you, because you are very much focused on arts and culture as part of, in the widest sense, the war effort, you know, making a peace deal that is lasting also means making sure that Ukrainian heritage, arts and culture are being preserved. Would you say that this orientation towards the West and Europe is also noticeable in terms of lifestyle, in terms of culture, in terms of art, upholding the rule of law, upholding a rule-based order, human rights, but also individual rights of people living their everyday life, which is clearly not the case in Russia. And I feel like increasingly not so in the US.
Yes, artists, musicians, filmmakers, they're doing a great job, not only documenting atrocities, not only documenting war, not only promoting Ukrainian narratives and trying to raise visibility about the truth. It's about saving an identity because Russia cynically targets museums, theaters, looting culture artifacts, daily bombardments where civic infrastructure and cultural infrastructure is being targeted. So here, our artists, they are doing important contribution for keeping, saving Ukrainian memory, Ukrainian identity, Ukrainian DNA, and trying to show the world our heritage and our achievements. And here I admire their work a lot. And culture and art can say something that maybe politicians can't say yet. So arts, it's a universal language that can be understood and perceived by very different target audiences and transmit the message that probably are not in the protocol of big political forums. So arts, it's a very, very strong tool and instrument to say what's going on. So we support, I personally support Ukrainian talents, and as the foundation where I work, Erste Foundation, we have also many, many programs. So I believe that each profession has, let's say, its own part of work, how you can contribute to the victory, and arts and culture play an important role here.
You said that this war is also about identity, and I very much agree with this. And I think many analysts that I've read also say that there is this almost genocidal element in the way that Putin has tried to wage this war. It's about people on the one hand, there is a demographic element, but it's also very much about negating the fact that Ukraine is a distinct country and a distinct identity, or even has its own language and so on. It's part of Russia, right? And so, of course, in this moment, art takes a critical role because, as you said, it's an expression of identity. Have you seen, or has there been documentation of Russian efforts to distinctly and specifically destroy Ukrainian art, Ukrainian monuments, and that also meaning to destroy identity or identity formation? So that's so the first part of my question, but also what are efforts to preserve actual artworks, monuments, buildings, testaments to the Ukrainian identity and to its specific cultural heritage?
For me, art, it's a form of resistance in a way. And we know it's already a fact that this war against Ukraine as a nation. It's not about only territories. It's also about, it's war of narratives. It's war of identities. It's war of values in a way. Many people mistakenly think that Russia and Ukraine somehow similar. Mm-hmm. You know, Ukraine has its own language, Ukraine has its own culture, and it has its own history of fighting for its independence. And war didn't start in February 2022. It started earlier. So this invasion has made even more had made Ukrainians even more determined to fight for its existence. So actually, it's a war for Ukrainians, for their existence. And what to add if Russia rewrites books, simply rewrites history, putting accents where that fits their narratives. So here, it's especially important to continue to do our work, to preserve our memory, to preserve our truths, to stick to these truths, to facts, to numbers, to historical events. And it's not only about artists, it's about historians. So about people with different backgrounds. So protecting paintings or protecting museums or protecting culture heritage, it's not about this object itself. It's about us. It's about truth about us. And sometimes arts and culture stays on the periphery of big topics, unfortunately, even in philanthropy world, or we see the money allocation or budget structures from big international stakeholders, arts and culture somewhere.
It's like a soft kind of policy that it doesn't seem to be.
Yes, but I really would like to change it somehow because it's not only about sculpture or painting. It's about our core, what makes one nation, what's different, exactly your identity, your memory. And I strongly encourage our partners to pay more attention to arts and culture heritage.
I think you're definitely onto something, because this is my last point I'm going to make about Trump, and then we stop that topic, okay? But I mean, his whole election campaign and also his first days in office really showed it is a culture war that he's fighting. This is about culture and identity, in his case, about Americans, or what he calls the American soul, right? So this is no longer on the fringes or the periphery, but it actually should be the center of our attention to preserve an identity, and in your case, a Ukrainian identity, that is dedicated to liberal values, for instance, that is dedicated to independence and freedom, that has its own heritage and history, and that is very distinct from Russia, actually. So I think maybe, if I want to be optimistic, the shifting world order that we see now, where also our opponents focus very much on culture and identity, at least brings with it a new realization that actually we should focus a lot on what other people tell us our identity is, what culture, what role culture can play, the importance of arts, the importance of history, the importance, as you said, of all these narratives, because yes, they might not be material, you can't touch a narrative, they actually have very material effects. As you correctly said, whole wars are being waged because of a narrative or a counter-narrative. So that's really crucial, I think.
Yeah, we should not underestimate this component of this war. Is hybrid war, all right? It's a digital war, it's a fake news war, it's a cultural war, of course, it's military war on the battlefield. And if you will learn in details what's going on with occupied territories and what transformations has been launched there, exactly to erase Ukrainian presence there. So, of course, streets renamed, new names of theaters, museums, new books, so everything. So it's a special separate plan of reintegration newly occupied territories to the Russia, to the Russian Federation. So obviously, it's not only about territorial integrity of Ukraine. It's a big master plan to simply erase the nation. What's the main points of Russian narrative? Ukrainian language does not exist. How you can say we are in 2025 that one language does not exist? So, and
that's colonial in its viewpoint.
It's a disaster. It's something unthinkable and something unbelievable. In Ukraine in 2017, 18, and 19, I was leading the Holocaust Center in Ukraine. I traveled around the world. I visited, I think, almost all Holocaust memorial centers and museums, and the main motto, never again. So the whole concept of education around the Second World War events, never again, never again. And again happened, yes. Again. And it's something dramatic that I witness right now, and it happens on the European continent. It happens just 6 hours by car from here to Ukrainian border. It's closer than from here to Tyrol, for example. Mm-hmm. When you think about this, how close this genocidal practice is right now to even us sitting here in the studio, personally, me, it frustrates and worries a lot. And when I think about all these negotiations and these big political events, the most frustrating thing for me that in the end, the price will be paid on the front line. So all delays, all additional rounds to negotiate a solution.
All conferences.
The price will be paid there. Every minute, literally. Even now, every minute, people dying. So what I would like to understand all those who are responsible for these negotiations and really can take a decision to think about people's lives. And that people dying and thousands of people already gone and so many friends, relatives. So it's something that we should keep in mind when we talk about big politics. You know, sometimes it's a gap in perception. We discuss big events, Oval offices and other things, but then there is a zero line where people suffering every second. So I think we should keep focus on this to save people's lives. And when we think about peace deal, it should be fair for Ukraine, for Ukrainian people, for those who already gave their lives and their families. So
it's also very much in their honor and in their memory that you need to have a fair deal. Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm just reminded of something that I think it was originally German journalist who wrote in New York Times after the Second World War, when the atrocities of the Holocaust were sort of really, really documented. He said, statistics don't bleed, you know, it's in the detail. That's where it matters. And as you correctly said, it's easy to lose track of people dying at the front lines when you're so much engaged and immersed in numbers and statistics. And of course, this is important, right? And it's about budgeting and it's about money. It's always about money in this world because this is the world we live in. But then the real price is not the money, actually. The real costs are the human lives. And this is something where I find in the current narrative, it's shameful how this is also being instrumentalized by those who want to cut aid to Ukraine, saying, oh, enough people have died already. Now let's stop it. Let's just stop it, you know. And as you correctly said, this is actually the wrong way to approach it, right? Because you don't want to have people to have died in vain. And for every additional day, more and more people will lose their lives at the front lines.
I think this war, in a way, a litmus test for the whole civilized world. Yes. And for international and European community, because we are here. And war in Ukraine already and will resonate far beyond its borders.
And it already does.
And it's not about, again, territory. So it will resonate. It's already resonates. So we will feel influence and sequences of this war. Million people left Ukraine. It's about and labor market integration and lots of refugees. So I think we should all synergize our efforts and even small step. Even small gesture can make a big difference and can make a big impact to bring Ukraine closer to victory.
And I really think we should not be naive as members of the European Union. I mean, in some way, Europe has already entered the war because we know that, first of all, just to give some examples, Russia clearly interfered in the Romanian elections, right? So this is also a question of how free are our elections if we know that Russian bots are actually trying to promote certain candidates that are very much in their favor. We also know that things are going on when it comes to undersea networks that are being targeted. They're hybrid attacks. There is clearly an instrumentalization of migrants and refugees at the Polish-Belarusian border, at the Finnish border, right? This is all very much orchestrated by the Russian regime. So in some ways, you could say Europe is already attacked, right? So who are we fooling, actually? It does concern us. And I think this hasn't really entered the debate yet to such a degree that people feel like they are not defending Ukraine. They are defending themselves, actually, by doing this. So this is really where I hope the conversation will be moving to now with the peace negotiations, where rightly so, Europe said, well, you can't have these negotiations without Europe because Europe is affected. Mm-hmm. And Europe is part, I think, already part of this war and has been for quite some time, you could argue.
You touched very important moment. Still, the rhetorics is war in Ukraine, help Ukraine, Ukraine's challenges, but if you will shift it and say our war, our challenges, when we will win. But Of course, people do not think in these terms. Still, there is a distance between what's going on there and we are here. It's again show us that a lot of work should be done about raising visibility, raising awareness, explaining what's going on. That's why we have a lot of program for media and journalists that are actually a cornerstone of any healthy and well-functioning civil society when you have access to the truth information, to the facts. So I agree with you that still we don't have this paradigm that it's our war. It's war somewhere there and we are kind of tired. And
we just wanted to go away. Just can it just go away, right? I think that's kind of the narrative some European countries still have. Let's just stop it, you know.
Yeah, but the price that Ukraine already has paid is very, very big. Mm. So it means that a negotiation process will be tough.
Yeah.
And on terms and conditions of Ukraine as well, they should be taken into consideration. It can't be designed without Ukraine.
I mean, another way in which Europe has been affected massively by the war in Ukraine was by many, many Ukrainians being displaced to EU countries and found host countries there. You yourself, like roughly 6 million other Ukrainians, you were displaced during the very first days, I think, of the total invasion, where a lot of the conflict was centered on Kiev. And so you fled to Vienna together with your daughter in early 2022. Now, I know that your little sister had already been in Vienna for some time and she was studying here. So I assume that this was one of the reasons why you chose Vienna, which again, by the way, shows the importance of social networks and community, which we always sort of stress as migration researchers. But was there another reason? Because I can imagine that for someone working in arts and culture, Vienna is almost like a natural fit. So I hope that you feel very much at home here because you're immersed in a society that values arts and culture a lot. Did that play a role in your decision?
Vienna was a very practical and meaningful choice. Many international organizations have their head offices here. It's a center of European decision making. It's a knowledge hub. Logistically, it's close enough to Ukraine. If I need to go there immediately or something urgent happened, I can easily get there. It was a mix of factors, a mix of components. Indeed, my sister lives here. My daughter learns German and she knew it even before the war. It always was as her second foreign language after English. And of course, I had networks, so I knew that I can probably find my professional way here. And yes, I was a leading culture department in Kyiv, at the Kyiv State City Administration. But it's not only about culture, it's about citizen engagement, it's about lots of building. So it's a hard bureaucratic work of public servants. So my experience helped me to find my way, and almost immediately I got employed by Erste Stiftung, where now I lead the financial aid that we allocate for Ukraine. We have many flagship initiatives and some emergency, let's say, response, smaller grants. We have beautiful portfolio now for media professionals, arts and culture professionals, civil society, anti-corruption programs. So different formats, study trips, fellowships, workshops. So we try to support Ukraine in different way.
Yeah, with a very small team, actually. It sounds like you have an office of 30 people, but it's smaller.
Yes, as far as I know. Erste Stiftung is quite small, but strong.
Powerful, yes.
Organization, that's true.
So in some ways, you are almost like a typical, I hope you don't mind me saying that, typical Ukrainian refugee, as in you are a young woman, you are highly educated, and you are a very strong and dedicated professional. And I had the experience both from personally meeting a lot of Ukrainian women in Vienna, but also from the studies and the demographic surveys that we conducted, that this is true for many Ukrainians, especially those who came to more sort of the Western European countries, highly professional group of people, women who are very dedicated to their jobs, women who have always been working in their lives despite having kids, and who actually demand more from their lives than just being given some sort of low qualified manual labor, because now they are considered refugees and their German might not yet be perfect. And this is, I think, something which I value, actually. This is, I think, something that some European host countries struggle with, because in their view, a typical refugee is someone who's completely destitute, who's almost illiterate, who will do all those jobs that the Austrians don't want to do anymore, manual labor, dirty, dangerous, difficult jobs, but not highly professional, academic jobs, right? And for many Ukrainian women, and I think I commend that them for that, they say, well, that's not enough for us, right? Actually, we had a great career back in Ukraine, and now we also want to do our part here. And this professional aspect is really important. And I also got to meet many women who, in addition to the state-sponsored German classes, paid for intensive German classes on the side because it wasn't enough for them. They wanted to learn more and faster and so on. So this great ambition and this drive is, I think, something that some host countries struggle with. But also, when we look at sort of the labor market data we have so far, it goes to show that our labor markets in Western European countries are not really flexible, and people don't end up in the jobs that they should actually end up in. So for you personally, I mean, you were lucky and you had almost immediately this great employment opportunity, and also you created more employment opportunities for other Ukrainians by this. But what is, in your view, what are some of the main challenges that Ukrainian refugees, most of them women, face in a wealthy, in a secure country like Austria that is doing a lot for integration, but it doesn't seem to have the right targeting in place? You know, it doesn't always seem to have the right fit for everyone.
Life of refugee is complicated. It's always balancing gratitude and grief.
You know,
it's very weird, ambiguous mix of feelings. And the biggest challenge is, you're absolutely right, it's finding job and coping with emotional stress at the same moment, because you left your life, you left your home, you left your friends and relatives. It's in a good scenario, you just left. In a bad scenario, your house was bombed and it's not there anymore.
Or you lost someone, right?
You lost beloved ones. So, and this is a huge challenge. It requires inner strength to cope with emotional stress, being so much traumatized, but at the same time building something new. And it's conflicting, contradictory, let's say, ways to experience yourself. So, and yes, you're right, you are experienced downshifting, because you are skilled, motivated, and in Ukrainian context, you are quite established, professional, known in your professional environment, and then you come to new environment and it's a new context and you can't copy paste just, you know, from one context to another. And here you should redesign your professional identity, and you should be agile and open enough to some new positions that, you're right, might not fit at all to your background and to your level of knowledge. So this is indeed the biggest challenge, especially if you have children and you should assist them in their integration, and you should be accompanying them in their coping strategies. So this is the very complex, and I don't wish anyone to know what is this, what does it mean to be refugees. So I think that even small assistance like mentoring, volunteering, creating job opportunities, maybe coaching, it's all these things can help to people to overcome this complicated stage of our lives, and uncertainty. It's also very harmful because you can't predict, you don't know what will happen, and to bear on your shoulders this level of uncertainty, this is probably something the most difficult, especially if you had your more or less organized life and you worked for it, and you had your job, your family, your house. So it's very, very dramatic. And Ukrainians need long-term security. Now it's again uncertain. We know that refugee status will be terminated in March 2026. And in Austria, Ukrainians were invited to apply for Rot-Weiss-Rot card. And
which is difficult for many to do.
Which is difficult, especially from people who offer some services. So it's difficult to be self-employed, let's say, to register your self-employment. About this, I can talk for an hour. What works, what doesn't? But if to give let's say a helicopter view, finding jobs, emotional stress, and this long-term security that Ukrainian people need, and you do it everything at the same moment, you know, and continue to take care about your Ukrainian part of life. I continue to pay for example for my apartment in Ukraine, for everything, water, electricity, some household expenses. So you pay for both lives, you continue. And my family is there, so it's very difficult to embrace this new circumstances. So I encourage all people to help in a way you can help, and even small gesture matters.
It's almost like a double identity, I could assume, right? Because especially for young children or young adults even who've been displaced to European countries because of the war, I mean, they sort of grow up in this culture here, and at some point it might be difficult for them to remember Ukraine as their home country, which is sort of an added stress level, I can imagine, for many of the mothers. So one Ukrainian woman just told me a few weeks ago, she said, well, you know, in summer we went back to Ukraine to visit the dad of my children who's fighting for us at the front lines, and we were there for several weeks, and at some point my little son said, Mom, when are we going back home to Vienna? And it broke my husband's heart, she said. But of course, I mean, for little children, it's been 3 years now, and some don't even remember their country, their home country, as their home. And they have their friends here, and they have their circle here, go to school. So that is, I think, an added challenge, clearly. And another thing that once was said to me right in the first weeks after Russia's total invasion was a young Ukrainian woman who said, you know, this experience of being displaced, of being a refugee, very much like you described it, it's like a second puberty. You have to start from new. Yeah, everything now goes back to reset, and you have to learn language, you have to learn the culture, you have to find yourself, and you also, your identity somehow changes now. You were an established professional, as you said, back in Ukraine. You had a great network, everything worked smoothly, you knew how things were working, and now you are uprooted and you have to learn everything again, and things are shifting. And so I can imagine that this is quite a high level of stress. And then, of course, as you said, worrying about those people who might be in Ukraine, what happens to them and what happens to your house there and what happens to your family and so on, adds another stress layer probably to all of this.
True. That very difficult to redesign, reinvent. You're basically reinventing yourself, your life, starting from the scratch. For me, it was new beginning. Mm-hmm. So new me in a new country, in a new city, and new working environment. Yes, all my previous experience serves and helps me, but basically I learned how to work in new corporate environment, different mentality, different dynamics of work, different style of management, different, I don't know, small traditions and rituals that any country, nation, city has. So it requires a lot of your inner resources. And from other hand, where you fulfill yourself again with these resources, where you have a moment of peace and satisfaction, this is a big question mark, and how long you can go and continue to do. That's why many people are completely burned out. Many people came back. Despite this danger, because it's too difficult. And each of us, we have different formula for mm-hmm. successful integration. You know, we have different package of skills. And I know many people that left Vienna, moved to another city to some reason. So it's difficult to start to move to one place. It's one thing to stay there and to organize your life in sustainable way. It's another task that Ukrainians try to accomplish now, because we entered fourth year of war. So mm-hmm. some people traveling back and forth, 1 year in immigration, then they came back, then they moved again because critical infrastructure continued to be ruined. So it's a very complex question, and I would advise to support Ukrainian organizations, Ukrainian businesses, Ukrainian professionals, buy Ukrainian books, watch Ukrainian films,
eat Ukrainian food,
buy Ukrainian fashion designers that are also part of arts and culture, doing a great job. So fashion industry, despite the war, is booming, and Ukrainian designers invited all over the world. I think by this we can make some difference. So because Ukraine is not only fighting for itself, it's fighting for our common peaceful, stable, green, democratic future, and we should do it together.
You are also doing something very specifically to support Ukrainian women in Vienna, because the Aste Foundation is sponsoring, supporting, organizing a program called the Professional Integration Hub, which offers employment opportunities, or tries to create employment opportunities for highly educated Ukrainian women who have been displaced to Vienna. Do you want to say a few words about this program? What's so special about it? What sort of its success rate has been so far? And how those listening to us, and those will mostly be Austrians, Germans, people from host countries, how they can support this program, or maybe even implement similar programs in their cities and in their countries?
Professional Integration Hub was launched 2 years ago, and now we are announcing already a third open call, and the community is growing. From my perspective, it's in a way a game changer, this program, because if you will try to find what kind of job opportunities exist, or what projects work in this area, mostly it's a website with vacancies where you can place your CV, and then nobody knows if match will happen between the candidate and the organization. We made it vice versa. First, we agreed with organizations that they will offer an internships, but I actually don't like the internship, because the word internship, it creates an impression that it's something like junior, amateur, you know, after studies. But this program of internship for established professionals with minimum 3 years of experience, fluent English, a certain level of German. And we agree with institutions that they create a place, special place for Ukrainians that were first forcibly displaced. So only those who moved because of war are eligible to apply. And we have great Austrian institutions that already took part, different ministries, and an Austrian Integration Fund, and Caritas Foundation, and Belvedere, and
but also private companies can participate.
Private companies can participate. I don't know why that mainly public interest institutions take part or philanthropy institutions take part, but not businesses.
The businesses don't know about it yet, but this will change now.
I hope so. So the idea is that we serve in a way as a door opener. So we
you do a lot of the work actually for the businesses, I would say.
We do. We have an expert pool, more than 100 people in our database now that were long listed and short listed for this program, and we maintain the contact with them. So most of them are still here in Vienna. So we offer different job opportunities in Vienna, Linz, Graz, Salzburg. So not only Vienna centered, let's say all over Austria. We do it for those who probably do not have enough networks, or with institutions that usually do not have vacancies and internships. So this program, it's like additional engine, let's say, for the system where we as the foundation, we cover all these expenses. So it's beneficial for hosting institutions, and because we financially compensate time for the interns from the hosting institution. We ask proper onboarding, supervision of work, in-depth engagement into real work, working station, of course. So hosting institution has a lot of responsibility on their shoulders. And the statistic is that more than 30% got an offer for prolongation. And then, of course, it's up to candidate and institution to negotiate all terms and conditions. We step out at that moment. So it shows that it's practical tool, how you can integrate one person to organization and a little bit to make this gap smaller, because there are thousands of unemployed people or employed where they don't have, let's say, perfect match with this position, as you said, maybe because it's slower, maybe because it's simply from other area and not related at all to what they know and what they can. So this professional integration of displaced people, it's big topic, and it requires big efforts from the government, from the municipality, from big organizations, from philanthropic institutions like our, for example. We raised this topic, we uncovered this problem. We had a stakeholder meeting in November last year with key organizations that are dealing with integration of refugees in Austria. And we try to exchange what could be a solution, how we can speed up this and to make beneficial for also. Professional Integration Hub, in a way, it's a model that is scalable and that can be repeated in different countries, in different cities, in different contexts. We have our methodology and we plan to continue. It's a small effort in contrast to the size of the problem, but still it's an example of good practices, and it works. And 30% got the invitation to stay, so we changed lives of these people, and now they are employed, and some of them already apply for Rot-Weiss-Ross visa. So it's something very tangible,
yes,
that you can say, this is what we did for these people. And I don't want again to say that it's only beneficial for Ukrainians. It's also very yes. beneficial for hosting organizations because energy, perspective, experience of Ukrainian professional enriches those organization, boosts new perspective, and we have only positive feedback from hosting institutions as well. So I position it as we are partners. So all of us, we are partners. It's not a gesture because of, you know, sorrow. No, it's a good working project where all involved, they get something good for themselves.
It's not a humanitarian project. It's actually something that very much helps to showcase the professional expertise of many Ukrainians. And as you said, enriches the Austrian labor market by doing so. I mean, we were talking about the peace deal and perhaps also reconstruction efforts that will happen sooner or later. It might be good to have networks to Ukraine and to know Ukrainians in your circle that you can build on and work with in the future. So I agree, absolutely, it's beneficial for both sides. Now, if there are businesses, company owners listening to us right now and they say, well, that sounds great, I want to be a part of this, where can they find the Professional Integration Hub? Do you still take applications of companies who want to offer internship positions, and how would they have to proceed?
Yes, we're still collecting organizations that are ready to offer an internship for 12 weeks for Ukrainian professionals. Open call will be launched late in spring, I think end of April or mid of May. So still we have 1 month to invite more organizations to take part. This project has its website, professionalintegrationhub.net. I don't remember, honestly.
But if you Google it, you can find it.
If you Google it, or you can approach directly me on in social media or through my email address. Usually I write very actively about all our initiatives, so don't hesitate to check my LinkedIn or Facebook, and of course my contacts on our official website of Erste Stiftung. So I will be happy to share information about this project. It's one of the biggest projects that we do in Austria, because mainly all of our projects in Ukraine that we implement together with local grassroots organization, and this one of the main projects that we do in Austria that targets exactly this topic of labor market integration. Mm.
And for everyone who cannot perhaps offer an internship position, we encourage them to buy Ukrainian food, to buy Ukrainian goods, to become interested in Ukrainian fashion and to check that out, what that means, and just become engaged in the community, right? Which would also be not only material support, but because we talked about this so much, this would also be cultural support and supporting Ukrainian as a distinct identity and Ukraine as a country that has a very rich heritage. And to familiarize yourself as a European more with this heritage, I think is also in some ways perhaps part of the war effort and of supporting the struggle for independence and for a sustainable peace.
Yeah, I think Ukraine needs two things right now to focus on. It's a human capital. It's crucial, and if we can support people, we should do it in different ways here and there, and in the manner that we can do it. And second, it's sustainability. I mean that support should be sustainable. It should not be like one-time shot, you know. So if you support Ukraine, support it systematically. Try to support it systematically. This will bring a big results in the end. So this is our focus as a foundation, and this is my personal focus, to work for Ukraine, with Ukraine, and to elaborate all projects, all initiatives with our Ukrainian partners. So it's not we decided that it's important. No, we together do what is needed, and we try to do it in a sustainable manner. We have long-term commitment to support Ukraine. Only then you can bring powerful ecosystem, long-lasting changes. So I invite different organizations, philanthropies, NGOs, experts to join us, to join our program. And of course, thank you, Judith, for the opportunity to share a bit about what we are doing and to share my personal story.
We appreciate you doing that. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your expertise. Thank you also for your courage and your commitment. As you said, it's not always been easy, but it's always been important and it will continue to be important. So thank you for all the work you're doing. Thank you for being here. Und bei euch bedanke ich mich ganz herzlich, dass ihr wieder mit dabei wart. Und ich freue mich, wenn ihr beim nächsten Mal wieder reinhört in Aufnahmebereit. Tschüss und Baba.
Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Wenn euch diese Folge gefallen hat, abonniert Aufnahmebereit auf Spotify oder allen anderen gängigen Podcast-Plattformen und folgt Judith Kohlenberger und der Chefredaktion auf ihren Social-Media-Kanälen. Fragen, Anregungen und Beschwerden an aufnahmebereit@wu.ac.at. Alle Infos findet ihr auch in den Shownotes. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Aufnahmebereit wird ermöglicht durch eine Förderung des Wissenschaftsvermittlungscalls vom Wissen der Vielen der MA7 der Stadt Wien. Danke an die KooperationspartnerInnen von die Chefredaktion und der Podcastwerkstatt.
Podcastwerkstatt.